Strange studies of strange stories.
She stared at her two companions for a moment, and then a sickening revulsion replaced fear. The fear that held each of the three in a terrible grip of inertia. Her slim hands bit hard into the back of one of the metal seats. The tiny rocket ship was plummeting to destruction, careening dizzily through space. Here, in the atmosphereless void, their motion was negligible to them, but instruments told a grim story. Unless they could blast the forward rockets very soon, they would be caught in the Earth's titanic grip and drawn with intensifying acceleration to its surface. They would come screaming down like some colossal shell, and the planet's surface would become a molten sore where they struck. And now, while precious seconds fled, the three of them stood transfixed, immobile.
Oh, man! I'm on the edge of my seat! What's gonna happen?
You know, sometimes we start the show with a reading that sets the mood, an overture, if you will. Mm. But that was a cold open, as they say in the TV biz. That's the kind of thing that makes you watch one more episode, even though you do have to be up in the morning.
And that was the opening paragraph from Leslie Perry's Space episode.
It's another short story from the anthology The Future is Female. And we're talking about it here on Strange Studies of Strange Stories. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey. Thank you for joining us on Patreon. Who was that reader?
Why, that was Kelly Maxwell, making her dramatic debut on the show. Kelly is a colleague of last week's reader, Heather Klinke, in the Monkey Business Institute. That is Madison, Wisconsin's favorite improv troupe. If you're in Madison, and I know I am, you can check them out. But Kelly is also in the band Little Red Wolf, and we're hearing some of that in the background now from their recent album, The Tops of the Trees. It's a really beautiful album, and I think it pairs well with today's story thematically. Disappointment in relationships and having to go it alone. But I don't want to give away too much about the story. Let's let that cold open hang off the cliffside for a moment. This author, Leslie Perry, is also combat rolling her way into the show for the first time. Again, the name Leslie, as with last week's author, Leslie F. Stone. Mm-hmm. That name, I assume, because it could be a man or a woman writing the story. I believe that's what they call gender sneaky.
Who calls it that?
It's just what I've heard.
Oh, okay.
I heard that on a podcast a minute ago.
Just a second ago. Yeah. Leslie Perry was born Doris Marie Claire Baumgart in Brooklyn, New York, to German immigrant parents in the year 1920. She got into writing via her husband, Frederick Pohl, who was in the Futurians, a well-known New York-based sci-fi fan group that produced a lot of editors and writers. Members included Isaac Asimov, James Blish, Donald A. Wolheim, many others.
Pohl and Baumgart married in 1940, but divorced 2 years later. During their period together, she edited and reportedly wrote most of the short-lived pulp magazine Movie Love Stories. And it was around that time that she wrote this short story as well. I wonder what that magazine was about. Did they write about the love stories in movies, or did they write love stories that would be worthy of a movie?
I would think the latter.
Yeah.
Because the first one would just be fan fiction, right?
Right.
She was also the founding member of the Fantasy Amateur Press Association. Not only a writer, she was also an illustrator. And all I could find of her stuff was some simple pen drawings, but there may be more out there.
Did you just look around the house?
She worked most of her life as a journalist while raising her kids.
See, I think it's funny that that's how you would look for her drawings. Now I'm going to check around. I couldn't find anything. And then, even more shocking, you did find some simple pen drawings. What are the chances? She published only two other short stories more than a decade later, both in science fiction magazines. Baumgart had a daughter with her second husband, the painter Thomas Owens, and a son by her third husband, the former Futurian, Richard Wilson.
She died in 1970 at the age of 49. Oh, man, too young, not cool.
Yeah.
And it was cancer. This story, Space Episode, came out in the December 1941 issue of Future Combined with Science Fiction, I guess is the name of the magazine. The story was controversial.
This story was selected as a story of the week in December 2018 by the Library of America. So they had a little entry about it, which read, during the fall of 1941, two relatively new pulp magazines, Science Fiction and Future Fiction, merged under the decidedly clunky title Future, Combined with Science Fiction. It's a terrible title for a magazine. Edited by Robert A.W. Lowndes, the second number of the joint magazine ignited a small tempest of controversy with the publication of Leslie Perry's Space Episode. Readers' scores indicated it was the lowest rated selection of the issue. One angry letter writer wrote, "Of all the hacky, sour, limping stories, this tops them all. Bah! Triple bah!" The short story that set off a small-scale battle of the sexes among science fiction fans featured an astronaut who comes to the rescue of her fellow space travelers, both of them men who freeze up when faced with a lethal catastrophe. Perhaps predictably, women found the story with its sardonic comments about heroes and heroism compelling and realistic, while male readers dismissed it as sour grapes. Lowndes considered the story a success because it served to show, if nothing else, that quite a few girls read Future. Moreover, unlike any of the other selections in the issue, the story has been reprinted several times in the 8 decades since it appeared, first in the May 1954 issue of Space Fact and Fiction, later in the landmark 1994 anthology New Eves, and most recently in The Future is Female, which is what we're reading from. But basically, that's like a familiar internet debate that broke out about the story in 1941, which I thought was cool. The Library of America notes also had this to say, which I found funny. Baumgart/Perry is mostly remembered today for Space Episode, the story that both turns on its head the cliched tale of a savior rescuing a damsel in distress and mocks the imagined heroics of science fiction readers. One envisions her attending the first science fiction conventions with their early cosplayers and thinking, "These guys? Really?" You know, we've mentioned it in the past, but this really made me think of the reality show you and I spent so much time developing and pitching, Star Captain.
Our idea was that there was this Federation-like intergalactic agency that has decided Earth was finally ready to be invited in and has made first contact, and it wants to choose the first star captain from our planet.
Yeah.
But, you know, instead of going to NASA, they want to find science fiction fans. They want to find people that understand what it means to be part of a Federation, and those are obviously people that watch Star Trek.
Putting, you know, the actual fans in stressful situations you might find on a Star Trek. We had, like, challenges where they had to eat weird things at an alien dinner, a la Fear Factor. You know, there were physical challenges, simulations, social challenges, and we hoped that it would be a, "These guys? Really?" Like, we were on that same premise, but maybe you'd get over that. I hoped you'd get over that hurdle initially and then see these folks in a new light as well.
Yeah.
Like, they would have actual skills that would come into place.
That's the arc of the show.
We got far with it. We had a design of the bridge, and we did uniforms and all these kinds of things.
Yeah. We were, I think we were even, we had a meeting with Michael Piller of Star Trek fame.
We did, and he and was interested in the show, but then passed away.
Right?
Yeah, we were in the middle of another meeting when we found out, and then the show kind of sank after that. And that was a sad day.
Oh, so that was 2005.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
This made me think of that to an extent. Last thing before I get into it. Mm-hmm. The story has a battle of the sexes element. It's definitely the value proposition of the story, but I actually think it undersells how good this story is. The reactions of the men I found to be understandable.
Oh, yeah.
Me, a man named Chad, could relate to these men. But I you know, I really felt they're not caricatures. There's a psychological realism to this that is past the man bites dog of it. I in fact, I would even say that there's kind of a twist, that understanding. But let's just get into it.
Sure. This is a very short story. It's only 5 pages long. We heard the setup at the beginning. A rocket ship is careening towards Earth. Their thrusters are jammed with an asteroid. They're going to crash. It's two men, Eric and Michael, and this woman, Lyda, on board. And they're freaking out because they're going to die. They all know what needs to be done. They understand the problem and it needs to be fixed. One person needs to go out there and clear out that asteroid, but the person that does it is not going to make it back.
There's an airlock situation, which I could perfectly imagine what it looks like from the gobs of science fiction I've watched.
Mm-hmm.
The outer door was ripped off in the accident. So whomever exits that ship is not going to be able to come back in. It's a one-way ticket, baby.
Mm-hmm. The woman knows both of the men are better qualified to do this job, but they're just freaking out. So it's on her.
The movie Gravity, of course, came to mind in this section. In fact, I think it has a very similar inciting incident. You know, it's a small particle or a small little meteor grouping. Striking it has massive repercussions.
Mm-hmm.
I think she says if they'd seen these meteors coming, they could have even burned out the one that lodged in the engine. But they just didn't know. Now that it's in there, if they try to do that, it's going to blow up the whole ship. Got to do a spacewalk in order to go get this piece of meteor out of the engine.
Yeah.
A time for heroics this, but none of them felt like heroes. Eric and Michael stood side by side, a sort of bewildered terror on their faces. This can't happen to us look. Neither had moved or spoken a word since the first investigation. So they're frozen at first, her as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's kind of the first cool thing about the story. They're facing reality for the first time. Mm. In all the talk about this story that I had read, the focus was on that these guys, I think the literary term is the bed, but they actually are pulp heroes. So listen to this. Okay. Lita found her confidence in them, that fine confidence she had known up till now, dissolving away, leaving her with an empty feeling which was greater than any fear could have been. She could not square them, as they were now, with the men she had known before, through innumerable terrestrial dangers on land, sea, and in the clouds. The three had had a planet-wide reputation as reckless and danger-despising, and now...
Michael slumped in his seat, dropped his head to his knees, groaning. Eric looked at her vaguely for a long second, then turned his eyes to the teleplate. Cold perspiration stood on his forehead. This was the dashing Eric Vane, one-time secret dream hero, close companion since that day years back when he and Mike had fished her out of the wreck of her plane somewhere in the Pacific. Suddenly, it all seemed amusing to her. The question of sacrifice lay between Michael and Eric. This was strictly men's work, but they were finding life a sweet thing. A sudden burst of laughter overcame her. There was such an amusing impotency to Eric's strength and the dash of his clothes. The knuckles stood white on his hands, cold, damp fear glittering on his forehead. And what of Michael, the gallant? He slumped in his seat, holding his face in shaking hands. Could this be the same man who had saved them all by scaling what was virtually a sheer cliff by night and obtaining help from neighboring Aborigines? All the dangers they had faced together and overcome together now crowded in her memory, one piling upon another. Scores of times one of them had unhesitatingly faced unpleasant death for the sake of all. She had been no exception.
So hold the phone. These are daring men. Mm-hmm. Like, they have already faced death, scaled that cliffside at night, and not wimped out. Also, she's got a thing for Michael. It says she recalled Michael saying with his arm around her shoulders, "When we get to Mars, you'll be the glamour girl of the planet. It'll be wonderful, Lita, just the two of us." His eyes had hinted at things he did not put into words. And even though she knew that nothing of the kind would happen so long as there were three of them, she had been glad for him then. Hmm. So they have this seed of a relationship. It's all potential. It's that perfect love. Nothing's gone wrong yet because it hasn't even started. So what is it? These adventurers are facing something different. What is it that's different this time as opposed to the other dangers?
I think the one thing that's really different here in this situation is they know one of them has to die. This trio, these guys have been through thick and thin and they've always managed to get out of it. But for sure now, they know somebody's going to die and there's nothing they can do about it. And I think that's what paralyzes them.
Right. They're facing certain death.
Yeah, I think.
I also thought it had to do with the adversary that they're facing. Space.
Hmm.
You know, like that thing that happened with William Shatner recently.
When he went up into space, he said that he had, I got a quote here, "It was among the strongest feelings of grief I have ever encountered. The contrast between the vicious coldness of space and the warmth nurturing of the Earth below filled me with overwhelming sadness." And this is something called the overview effect, which a lot of astronauts have experienced. And it's was coined by Frank White in 1987. This is what he says about it, Frank White. He says, "There are no borders or boundaries on our planet except those that we create in our minds or through human behaviors. All the ideas and concepts that divide us when we are on the surface begin to fade from orbit and the moon. The result is a shift in worldview and in identity." Basically, you see everything. It puts it all in perspective. And also how there is an infinite amount of death out there. And there's this small little place where there's life, our planet. And you can really see that when you're up there. And a lot of people experience what Shatner experienced. And just like, oh my God, this is a tiny little thing and it's not protected. It's vulnerable out in this death of the abyss. And, you know, that's space. So yeah, it's some heavy stuff.
Even Shatner shat the bed. Captain Kirk was even scared in the face of this adversary.
Well, sure.
You know, it's the ultimate chaos. It's the ultimate death. It's the ultimate emptiness.
Yeah.
And this is the first space flight we discover for this crew. They're not like Stina in our first story of the month.
No.
These aren't spacers.
No.
She imagines the picture of Michael opening the outer door of the rocket on the night they left, bowing gallantly, speaking extravagantly dear words of welcome to her on their first space flight. And she laughs about it.
Mm-hmm.
I bet this is actually the part that drove the male readers crazy. Michael's head shot up suddenly. Stop laughing! Stop it! He covered his face with his hands and Lita felt sick. He was crying.
Yeah.
He burst into tears. They didn't. I know you can relate to crying.
Oh boy, can I? I'm crying right now. She paused, her eyes filled with bitterness and contempt. Then she smiled wearily, feeling strangely akin to the vacuum outside them. There was only a sudden decision and she made it. This was her exit, and to hell with the heroes.
So she's going to be the one to step up. She regrets that they didn't let fate decide. They could have chosen fairly. They could have at least made a pretense of flipping a coin.
Mm-hmm.
Then I thought there was also some psychological realism and breaking of the form again here when it says, would she make a television headline? Would they name a ramp after her or perhaps someday a rocket division? There were several photos of her in newspaper files. She hoped they would pick a good one when they ran the story. Oh, hers would be a heroic end. I thought it was neat that after having been thrust from the fictional world they're used to living in, the pulp world, mm-hmm. and suddenly in this real certain death world, which they're not dealing with well. But even then, some of her last thoughts, how will I be portrayed fictionally? Who will play me in the TV movie? I hope they picked the good picture on file.
Yeah.
You know, one of the worst things ever was headshots. That was always something you had to get as an actor when you're auditioning.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was like the most torturous thing ever. Pick this one picture that perfectly represents you, you know, commodify yourself to an extent.
Yep. Oh.
And it was like always something I would put off and never wanted to do. But then something would come up and you'd go, God, I wish I'd done that.
Yeah.
I imagine this would be that situation. Why didn't I get those headshots?
I feel pretty proud of myself of living in LA for 16 years and never getting headshots.
You never had them done, huh?
Nope.
I got some bad ones. I'm proud of you too.
And some great ones. Now, it says here, on the black glistening floor of the cabin lay Eric's glittering iridium-woven spacesuit. He had ventured that much at least, pulled it from the locker and tossed it onto the floor. She stepped to the suit, smiling grimly. It was much too long and wide all over. Her fingers were swift and sure, adjusting the steel clamps.
So the author is not going to skirt around the metaphor? No pun intended, this is a woman stepping into a man's shoes. And it also implies that there's no spacesuit on board for her.
Mm-hmm.
Or she just didn't have time, I guess, if there is one.
I don't know.
I thought, wouldn't they at least, in such an emergency as this, say those other two had been killed with what messed up the ship, like that they wouldn't give her a spacesuit?
Hmm. Just as she's about to leave, Eric finally steps up and says, no, it should be me. And she's like, dude, no, it's too late. You've waited too long. We don't have time for me to get out of this and you to get into it. We would all die, of course.
He 100% did that on purpose,
yes,
man.
Totally.
I have also done that where you kind of linger, like you're distracted, and they go, oh, do you need some help? When the thing's almost done.
Yeah.
I did that all the time when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
Michael isn't saying anything to her, the other.
He's just kind of zoned out. On a sudden impulse, she darted over to Michael and she struck him sharply across the face. He looked up suddenly, his eyes widening in amazement. Aren't you going to say goodbye? Michael says, there's no point. Just stay with us. We'll all go down together.
What do you think of that impulse?
I think that is about how if she does do this, he's got to live with that after the fact.
Yeah.
And if they all just die together, then they're all dead and they don't have to deal with it.
In some ways, it's kind of noble. Like instead of making one of us make this choice, let's all make the choice and just die so that I don't have to force somebody into giving everything up. And then, so nobody has to live with survivor's guilt, because that's pretty bad. Imagine, I feel bad enough when I'm laying around watching TV instead of getting my work done. Imagine if someone had given their life for me.
Yeah.
I'd never enjoy anything again. I really should be doing something with my life.
You go, I've been playing Cyberpunk 2077 for 4 hours.
Lita died for me to do this. She shakes her head defiantly. No, there's still time. Goodbye, Michael.
So she goes out there with the equipment. She dislodges the asteroid. Once out, the force throws her into space.
There's some good space action, by the way. Even though this is a 5-page story, it's got all the good sci-fi stuff in there. She gets thrown into the wall of the exposed airlock when she goes out there. Hurts her arm. It's solid. She sees the path of the meteor on the ship, gets that torch, gets to work, fixes the problem. I think here is where we really meet the antagonist.
Space lay around her, and as she worked, she felt a nameless dread seep into her being. The face of the planet was directly above. Desperately, she tried not to look at it. Despite her efforts, she could not help but glance upward at its looming immensity, cringing as she did so. It was so horribly large, falling on her. It seemed to be drawing her up the way an electromagnet catches a piece of scrap iron. And around her was space. Space filled with pinpoints, billiard balls, and footballs of light. She knew she must not stop to look at them. They would charm away her senses and burn out her eyes. She knew this without ever having been told. There was a horror in space. Not anything alive, but a dread that chilled and stole away one's life. She understood now why men who had faced all manner of terrestrial dangers had become weak and helpless here.
Added to that, it says they had been fools, all of them, to come on this flight without conditioning. Space was no place for humans unless they had been conditioned to it gradually. And they had thought themselves so clever in the way they had evaded the requirements for a license. So they didn't do their training.
No.
It makes me think back to that Twilight Zone. It was might have even been the pilot. Is anybody out there where it's the guy who's all alone in the town and slowly goes crazy? And the twist at the end is you discover he was in astronaut training. They were trying to see how he would hold up under isolation. Because we were talking before we jumped on here about, you know, your kids maybe want to be astronauts, maybe.
Oh, one of my, my young, he's eight. So, you know, how many eight-year-olds? Mm-hmm. You want to be a paleontologist? You want to be an astronaut? You want to be a fireman? You know, all these things. So
and you're just trying to talk him out of all of that
stuff,
right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I don't want him to do any of those things.
Well, if he's a paleontologist, going to be attacked by dinosaurs.
Yeah. Some jerk is going to figure out how to bring him back from the dead, call him up because he'll be an expert.
But in the case of an astronaut, you get into it thinking it's going to be some kind of space adventure. But really, it's about those kinds of, to me, like David Blaine-esque survival skills. It's about being able to survive in isolation, not be claustrophobic. It's like more about endurance.
Oh, yeah. And just like drinking your own pee and the stink.
Yeah.
You know, that's one of the things I've heard the astronauts talk about is when they get up to the space station, it just freaking smells so bad.
What does it say about me that those two things you just, I didn't even occur to me. Oh, drinking my own pee, the stink. Yeah, no big deal.
I could probably manage those things too. I mean, your pee doesn't taste like pee. It's been filtered and cleaned and everything like that. Just
tastes like Tang, right? That's what I'm led to understand. It tastes like Tang.
You're just crammed in this little space with, you know, a handful of other people that you're going to be in super close quarters. None of the comforts that you know. Like, you can't lay down. That just doesn't exist. You float. You get strapped to the wall and float there to sleep. Like, I'm so particular about how I have to sleep. I have to be in a certain position, the pillow just a certain way, or I can't get to sleep. And these poor sods go up there and are just floating around and their arms are flying and in eating. Gravity helps you eat so much. And you don't have gravity to, like, help your food go down in your guts. So it's going to come right back up your throat. It's terrible. Why anybody would want to do that is beyond me.
I just rode the elevator to the top of the St. Louis Arch and I was like, all right. Kill me now. I'm done. This is terrible. And here they are out dealing with that. No training, as well as just seeing outer space. I mean, think about how much training went into William Shatner did to be Captain Kirk. That must have been 10 years at NASA, right? Before they let him get behind the chair of that.
Yeah, yeah.
These guys have none of that.
No.
They face the ultimate adversary, the chaos of space. It says a single tear ran down her nose and she thought, I hope they go to hell. Damn them. But in space, no one can hear you resent. She kicks herself away from the ship and she goes out into her death orbit.
Earth loomed above her. She had not the acceleration of the ship. Soon it would leave her behind. She would float out here in an orbit of her own. A second moon. Perhaps a meteor would strike her someday. Perhaps in the future, space voyagers would find her and bring her home. Soon, within an hour at the most, there would be no more air. But why wait hours? With a sudden movement, she threw open the helmet of her suit. The ship was gone now. Michael and Eric were safe. And something tenuous had clamped itself over her nose and mouth so that she could no longer breathe. For an instant, she struggled, lungs bursting as in the throes of a nightmare. Her thoughts cried out, "Michael! Michael!" The darkness gathered her in.
And that's the end of the story.
It's so well written, and it hits hard. What would you do in those last minutes if you had like an hour left in a spacesuit and you were just floating out in space? Would you just end it, or would you sit with that last hour?
Oh, I'd take every bit of time that I could get. But, you know, I made a joke about in space no one can hear you resent, but that moment there really made me think about it because she is living on resentment right now. You know, that oftentimes in life we'll do something that's uncomfortable for us, and the cold comfort we get from it is having that over somebody else.
Sure, yeah.
You know, that just you can walk around and go, oh, they didn't man up, but I did.
Yep.
And you resent them, and that's kind of like your reward, as dark as that is. And here at the last moment, that's not left to her either. Her last thoughts cried out, Michael, Michael. That perfect love, the potential of that relationship is what she wants. And that was like so heartbreaking to me. I mean, I guess you can interpret that, her thoughts were thinking however you want. Because maybe she was going, Michael, Michael, what a jerk. But I really thought that it was that idea of in her last moments, she was missing physically, you know, she was going away from having contact with somebody and hit me.
I think in those last moments, you don't know, obviously, what it's like to be floating out in space and know you're going to die in an hour. But I think I would go through like my greatest hits. I do a clip show of my life in my head and just try and think of all those great things that I did. And then once I'm done, I still have 50 minutes.
That's a lot of time. You know, there's this series they do on YouTube where they'll, and I'll link out to it because I can't offhand recall what it is, but it's basically illustrations of folks from archival tapes talking about certain topics. So there's some from Kurt Vonnegut or Ray Bradbury. And there was one from Francis Ford Coppola where he expresses something very similar to what you were just saying. He said that every night when he, at a certain period when he was leaving Zoetrope Studios, he had to take a long elevator ride down. And when the elevator doors would close, he'd think, this is, I'm dying. Huh. That little trip down in the elevator, he'd go, what if I died right now? And he would try to think through what he would think about, you know, did I have a family? Did I do good? Have I made some good stuff? And by the end of the ride, he'd go, yeah, I think I would be okay with dying. I've had a pretty good life. The doors open and he's like, oh, look, I've got all this life left. So it's just like a little game he would play with himself all the time. And what you just said kind of reminded me of that. I'll link out to it in the show notes. It's a pretty charming little story.
Yeah.
So anyway, I can't blame the men in the story for crumbling in fear in the face of space, the ultimate monster. However, I don't want to play down the fact that she did take care of business, this woman. And for a female reader in the 40s, that must have been awesome. Because I have read most of what's going on in these pulps at the time, and it is not this. The female characters are there to be romantic interests, and that's it. So for her to be the hero of this and to be able to step up when the men couldn't, must have been an incredible reading experience for the female readership of this magazine.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that this is something that still is going on in our society, in our culture. Women are not valued. Pew study, this is from 2022, said that women in the U.S. still only earn 82% of what men do for the same job. At home, according to the Office of National Statistics, in 2016, women do 60% more housework than men. And when it comes to childcare, according to a study by the Center of Global Development, women do about three times more childcare than men do. YouGov data says that 2 in 5 women who work full-time and have a partner, 38% of them say that these tasks, you know, household tasks, taking care of children, fall on them, where only 9% of men in that same situation. So that's a huge disparity. And, and to me, I hear what this story is saying. Like, women are the backbones of almost all human societies, and they do not get the recognition that they deserve.
Nor do they get the spacesuit that fits them that they deserve.
Which I think
is why that was left out in the story.
So part of me feels like that was a little bit in this story as well, if not the theme of it. It's like, look, when stuff needs to get done, it's the women that are taking care of the business.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought it was a great story, and I really enjoyed it. Next up, we've got a story called The Miracle of the Lily by Claire Winger Harris. That's also from this anthology. Yep, yep. I've read that one already. It's pretty cool. Lots to talk about there. I want to thank some of our patrons.
Ooh.
I'm going to thank Bethany Haig.
I want to thank John Hazard.
I'd like to thank Trev Boyd.
Ben Robson, thank you.
Ryan Hamburg, thank you so much.
I'd like to thank John Mills.
Evan Nelson, thank you.
Nicholas Rudd, thank you very much.
Peter Sjolund, thank you.
And Ann B., thank you so much for your support.
Finally, I want to thank our reader today, Kelly Maxwell. We threw a lot of text her way, and she did a great job. Also love her band, Little Red Wolf. We'll link out in the show notes so you can go pick that up. For now, I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Exclusively on Patreon.
Strange Studies of Strange Stories.